Good morning. 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 Bad morning. Any kind of morning. So, if you've ever wondered, if you've ever been tempted to have a job answering the phone at a school, then you consider this training for such a role. I don't know if you'll be, we hope you can hear this well. We'll try. This is Cheap Family Entertainment. If it works. Stay tuned.
Hello, you have reached the automated answering service of your school. In order to assist you in connecting to the right staff member, please listen to all the options before making a selection. To lie about why your child is absent, press 1. To make excuses for why your child did not do his homework, press 2. To complain about what we do, press 3. To swear at staff members, press 4. To ask why you didn't get information that has already been enclosed in your newsletter and several flyers that have been mailed to you, press 5. If you want us to raise your child, press 6. If you want your child to touch, slap, or hit someone, press 7. To request another teacher for the third time this year, press 8. To complain about bus transportation, press 9. To complain about school lunches, press 0. If you realize this is a real world and your child must be accountable and responsible for his or her own behavior, classwork, and homework, and that it's not the teacher's fault for your child's lack of effort, hang up and have a nice day. Thank you for your interest in public education.
So, our topic today is ethics and education, just to make sure we got everybody's expectations on board. See, I looked forward all week to hearing Adam McNeil's class on ethics and mediation, because I have to do some of that in my job, only to come to class and find out that the schedule said ethics and meditation. So I sat over there ticked for the first 15 minutes. So I just want to make sure everybody's expectations are, you know, like when you get on the airplane and say this plane's going to Tampa, I'm thinking, how do you get that far and not know? Expectations are important. So the handouts are back there and over there. We have the little famous Scotch box on the top. And probably the jumping off point for this would relate to basic motivation, love of God and love for others. Matthew 22, 37 to 39 contains that classic comment, love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor is yourself. And schools are full of neighbors, which can be problematic. But how am I trying to do that? What am I trying to accomplish? So education is a emotional as well as intellectual endeavor. I have a friend who is a leader in a large Christian school, and he says, what I do is not very controversial. I'm only dealing with people's children, religion, and money. So it's, I mean, how easy can it get in life? So it can be challenging. But I think part of what's important in this is to, I probably need to tell you where I'm coming from and what my personal experience is, because that's going to shape how I think about this topic. So in the spirit of transparency and whatever, if you don't know me at all, then this may or may not be helpful. I started coming to Covenant in my mother's womb. Didn't hear much then. But I went to Lakeland Christian School from 4th to 9th grade as a student. I went to a Christian boarding school from 10th to 12th grade, University of Florida after that. And also studied at USF and Nova Southeastern University. And I've in my 48th year at our school. So I've had a bunch of different jobs in the same place the last 20 or so as head of school. My children, who are now 37 and 42, both went to Lakeland Christian all the way through and went to Covenant College for their higher education work. And that was a really beneficial investment, and that their education there was, if you drive up to the college, on the bottom of the sign at the front of the campus, it says, "In all things Christ preeminent." So as I heard them talk about their education and I compared it to my education at the University of Florida, it seemed that my education was more and more interested in fragmenting knowledge into lots and lots of pieces. And their education was about uniting all fields of knowledge under the Lordship of Christ. So when you have, that's a pretty good contrast of how you skin the cat educationally in a secular venue versus one that's trying to do it from a biblical perspective. So the scope of this class, we're not going to spend any time talking about where you should send your kids to school. We're not going to spend much time talking about some of those kind of things. We'll mention those in passing. And we're not going to spend time talking about Christian education in the church. We're going to primarily be focused on schooling. And so my entire public school teaching experience is less than a year during my college training. So I'm not going to comment on how to navigate those waters from an educator's perspective. There's plenty of people around here you can talk to about that. I don't feel qualified to address that. So on your handout, the purpose of education, we're talking about schooling here, K-12 primarily. So what happens in schooling? So there's a real merger here of philosophy and ethics and values, and you know, it's not in neat little boxes. So some of these things overlap a little bit. But basically, when you're looking at schooling, why do cultures start schools? You're going to learn a culture. There's basic beliefs about a culture handed down to the next generation. I mean, that's pretty basic. So we know that parents are the primary teachers of their children. Nobody has more influence than a parent. But there's also a lot of other teachers in our culture today other than parents. Probably the biggest in educational system we have going today looks like this. And that's a problem. So, but you got cultural transmission. So Newell talks about formal education is not just passing on propositional truth, not just propositions about what's true. A lot more stuff is being passed down than that in every venue for education. So he says, telling the Christian story over a flood of dissonant noise and activity takes determination, also takes a lot of intentionality. So Gordon Clark, in his classic text on Christian philosophy of education, says the Christian system starts with God, not just any sort of God, but with a very definite God, the God of the Bible. Major difference between secular and Christian ethics is that the former judges the goodness or badness of an act by a doubtful calculation of its possible consequence, whereas the latter judges the rightness or wrongness of an act by precepts divinely revealed to the Hebrew prophets and Christian apostles. So we're operating as Christians in the context of understanding creation, fall, redemption, restoration, and what flows out of an understanding of that order of reality. So that shapes your epistemology, which is how do you know what you know, and ontology, what's real, and the whole thing flows out of a biblical understanding. But the Christian epistemology, how do we know what we know, includes revealed truth. So we learn all those other kind of ways like everybody else learns, the experience and study and expertise and intuition and all those kind of things. But we also have revealed truth that anchors our view of reality and anchors our ethic. So that's distinctive. So the question, what kind of persons are we trying to cultivate and why? So which culture are we trying to hand down? Which set of beliefs are we trying to pass to the next generation? So a secular mission of a secular education is that you're going to raise up good citizens to function well in the culture and the political and social environment of a particular culture. So it is to all of our advantage to have a strong public school system, to have an educated electorate. Would be nice if we spend a little more time in the civics class.
Yeah.
That's a topic for another day. But anyway, so the Christian schooling effort, they're trying to equip citizens for God's kingdom, for the glory of God and for his kingdom. So you go back to that verse we started with about love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Now, if I could be a little internally critical here, I think a lot of times the Christian school effort has focused on the mind, the biblical worldview piece, about these propositions that if we get people to think right, they're going to live right. I just think about that a minute. So how do you do with that? How good do you live in accord with your propositional truth that you believe? Okay? I know certain propositions about food. I don't live by that truth. Okay? So how do we deal with that? So thinking about those three things, James K. Smith is a writer that's done a lot of work with this. Talks about you are what you love. And Smith's contention is that our worldview is shaped more by what we love than by what we think. So when you're thinking about educating your children or your grandchildren, how do you cultivate love for the right stuff? Smith has a marvelous chapter or two on the mall as a religious experience. And he has, what is the prelude? What is the praise? What is the what? What is the sermon? What is it all about the elements of worship that we practice every Sunday? And which piece of the mall carries out that role? It's fascinating. It's scary, but it's fascinating. But what are we? How do we generate? What do we have? How do we help our kids love the right thing? Love is irrationally cultivated. How can I sit in a stadium with 85,000 people, put my arm around some woman I don't know and sing We Are the Boys from Old Florida and feel a unity of all these people? That is an effective domain, cultivated affection for this institution that's probably done more to rip the faith out of Christian students than anything I know about. So how do I feel this great identity with this effort? You know, how does that work? So thinking about cultivating affection, or how do we cultivate affection of our children for the church? They love to love the church, and they love to come to church. It's not just about the propositions we teach them. How do we cultivate their love for that? So I think one of the things we're trying to figure out is how do you cultivate those tastes? So they're not a brain on a stick sitting in a desk. And if we put all the right propositions in there, they're going to go out and live right. I don't think that's going to play out on the ethical front or in a lot of other fronts too. So it's a challenge. So there's a lot of delivery systems here for education. Public school, non-sectarian private schools, that is non-religious private schools, that I read a bunch of research a number of years ago that said that was probably the most lethal setting for faith. Interesting thought there. Home education. Next to the last version of World Magazine, if you don't get World, it's a commercial for you. There's an interesting article here on home education, homeschoolers, and fewer than half of them do it for religious reasons, and a lot of interesting pieces in here. But one of the intriguing things is California, of all places. They have a charter homeschool scenario where homeschool families get money from the state to buy their homeschooling materials. How bizarre is that? You know, and so stranger things have happened, just not lately. But how that movement is going, and there's no government control over, you get your money and you can do with it whatever you want to, for your spending on your kids' schooling. So that world is changing too. Now, there's Christian school option, which is obviously the context with which I'm most familiar. The real difference between Christian schools and all other educational systems, public or private, must be traced back to its source of two antithetical worldviews. On the one hand, the worldview that takes the living God, creator, revealer, redeemer, as its starting point, listening dependently to his revelation in scripture, creation, and providence. On the other hand, the worldview that explicitly or implicitly denies that God of the Bible is the source of all reality and the measure of all truth. From these fundamental starting points, all the surface characteristics that mark off Christian education from humanistic education flow with varying degrees of consistency. I would underline that last part. So I'm interviewing Jeff Saber, who's our director of biblical studies and worldview at school, and he's coming out of Florida State and science education major. So I asked Jeff in the interview, I say, what distinguishes you from the teacher down the hall from you doing your student teaching at Leon High School? What distinguishes you from the teacher down the hall? And Jeff said, I have a starting point. So that's the key, is understanding the starting point and what follows from that. So you have online education too, which is a hot thing. And Newell's interesting comment, their efficiency promoting proposals for education are likely to miss the way human beings come to know themselves. Now, I'm old, so I'm not a real big fan of online learning. I have a lot of people that work for me that are younger, fortunately, and that just really love doing grad work online. Okay? So there's that model has, I think, has a lot of wonderful potentials. It also is driven a lot by the capacity that you can have can be financially very efficient and generate lots of money with less overhead than regular education. So there's a lot of financial drive to do online stuff. I was talking to a couple of our grads there at Florida a couple weeks ago. They're talking about how much of their coursework is pushed to online instead of being live in the classroom. And I was really saddened by what they're missing. But, you know, some of the people we've all sat in class with, you know, life would be fine for us to miss those people. But there are other people that enrich that whole experience. And it's just different talking to somebody and seeing them and seeing their body language and seeing their eyes and seeing their reaction than just seeing what they type on a screen. That's a totally different experience. And so a lot of that's financially driven. Decision process, where are you going to put them? That's a value proposition. What do you think it's worth? What are resources are available to the family? Where is it? The location of a school, its acceptability to a school, to a family is directly proportional to the age of the child. So if they're going to preschool, they want it to be within 10 minutes of their house. If they're high school, I'll let them drive 40 minutes. You know? But so location matters. Access is a big deal. Some of that is obviously financially driven. If you're talking about an independent school such as ours, people have to pay tuition. So there's an accessibility issue. But in G, I want to emphasize that. No, there's no guarantee of student outcomes with any of these systems. There's no system of educational, there's no delivery system for education that an unengaged parent can't sabotage. Okay? So if my child's in a public school, then I have to say, okay, understanding philosophically what's going on there and ethically what's going on there, then how do I need to compensate for that at home? If my child's in an online school, how do I need to compensate for what's missing pieces of that? If my child's in a Christian school, I can't assume I can farm all this stuff out to the school. They got it covered. Now I still have to be engaged with what's going on because they're going to deal with people with differing beliefs and different perspectives theologically and everything else. We got 150 churches represented in our student body. Okay, so you're going to get some stuff. Okay, so there's no free lunch here for parents. You still have to be engaged with the child in the educational process, especially in the realm of ethics. So, in ethics expressed in the curriculum. Now, curriculum is what is taught. It's not the textbook. The textbook and the printed stuff or online stuff or whatever is what they use. Those are tools to teach. So, what are they teaching? There's three dimensions of curriculum. One of them is a written curriculum. What do we say we're teaching? Okay, everybody's got those. Here's what we say we're teaching. Here's how long it's going to take. Here's how we're going to assess it. All that. So stated goals, all that. The null curriculum is very powerful. The null curriculum is what will not be addressed. Okay? So critical decisions about curriculum are always select neglect. That's the hardest part of preparing for this class. What am I going to select? What am I going to neglect? Because I don't have, you know, I'm not going to cover this in 48 minutes. So how are you going to do it? So those decisions are shaped a lot. There's a lot of ethical decision making that goes on about the select neglect curricular decision. So null curriculum, what are you not going to talk about? What are you not going to address? So if you take a situation in a secular school setting, religion, for example, could only be talked about descriptively. It could not be talked about prescriptively. Okay? I could describe it, the Bible as literature. I could describe the different religions of the world. I could describe this, that, and the other thing. But I cross a line I'm not allowed to cross when I say, you should believe this about God. Okay? A student teaching in Hawthorne, if you know any idea where Hawthorne is, it's 20 miles. It's 20 miles in about 200 years outside of Gainesville. Okay? So I got this other student teacher who comes to me and says, Mike, I know you're a Christian. I'm supposed to do the sociology class, comparative religions. Would you come in and do 4 days on Christianity? I said, well, okay. So I went in there, and there wasn't anybody in there except me and the other student teacher. That was a policy violation to start with. So I talked about the gospel for 4 days, gave him an opportunity to pray to receive Christ, did follow-up meeting in the home, all this kind of stuff. I thought, if they knew about this in the county office. Now, I'm not sure. I was really compelled to share, I really wanted to do that. In my youth and exuberance, I'm not sure that was an ethical thing to do, given that whole context. I'm not sure I was in bounds, but I didn't have enough sense to think through that at that stage in life. So null curriculum. So what you can't deal with, so if you're dealing with a curriculum that's driven by naturalism and empiricism, you have no way to deal with purpose, meaning, love, all that stuff that's not measurable, that you don't get out of personality. Where's all that stuff come from? So he can't really deal with that purpose, meaning, big picture deal. So I'm talking to the RUF minister at Harvard 2 or 3 years ago when I was up visiting my daughter in Boston. And I'm saying, well, it must be interesting at Harvard, because you got to dealing with these big questions of life with these people. And he goes, no. No, kids at Harvard, they don't care about the big questions of life. They don't care about purpose. All they want to know is, how do I get to the top? How do I get to the top? And the other stuff, how do I get to the top of the corporation? How do I get to the top of the pile, power, economically? How do I do that? They don't want to talk about meaning and purpose. And they don't, So the hidden curriculum is probably the most powerful. That's the informal cultural norms in a place. It's the climate of the school, not the weather. The weather changes day to day. The climate is the big deal. So we have people leave our school sometimes because they have a bad weather day. And they go to a climate that's nuts, So what's the climate, the atmosphere, what is taught? By all the informal interactions and values. So how does schooling impart their image, preferred image of what human beings ought to be like? So this is an interesting comment. I read this in earlier this year. David Coleman, who's the CEO of the College Board, okay? The SAT and all that stuff. That's what they do. So here's an interesting comment. And it's in the context of schools becoming vocationally oriented to the exclusion of bigger picture stuff. Same concerns apply to high school graduates starting a first job. Readiness is for more than just college or career. It's being prepared for the responsibilities of citizenship and the weight of adult decisions. Those are matters of character as much as skill, which is why our school should encourage a deeper exploration of the spiritual world, a more thorough introduction to public life, and a wider engagement with age-old questions of the soul. I found that intriguing. So you're the teachers in at home school, it's the parents, they're the living curriculum. They model what's important to them. Model the gospel. They're either gospel-centered or centered on something else. And realize, you know, the weather changes. People have better days than other days. But the climate is a profound teacher. So think about the ethics of the participants. Who are the players? Student ethics. So if you have students in your life, or you have grandchildren in your life, or whatever, or you're a student yourself, your calling at that point in life is to be that of a student. That's what you're called to do. If you think about vocational calling in the old Puritan sense, what has God called you to do? At this stage in your life, God's called you to be a student. So study and do your best. Now here's a concern that I have that's shared by a lot of people. Integrity and cheating in schools. So the pervasive nature of academic dishonesty in America today is a disturbing indication that the intellectual honesty has fallen on very hard times. A recent survey of 18,000 high school students by Rutgers University professor Donald McCabe confirmed what other studies have been suggesting for years. Approximately two-thirds of American students cheat on exams. Students in over the last 40 years have shown that those who cheat in high school continue to cheat in college and beyond. In other words, acts of intellectual dishonesty are not simply isolated events, but can become a fundamental part of who we are. And when this happens, the consequences to our lives and to the society we live in are devastating. Our relationships are built on trust. When we are found to be deceptive in one area of our lives, we sabotage the potential for gaining and keeping the trust of others. And when that happens, our chances of developing meaningful, happy relationships are poisoned. So, Dal goes on further to say, all of life, they go through life weighed down by guilt, deadening of the conscience, and they can't trust themselves. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you've worked with a lot of little kids and on a playground situation, and there's a conflict somewhere. And what I've noticed is that a child who has a real propensity to lie assumes everybody else does too. So beware of the child who always is accusing others of lying, because they tend to just assume everybody else functions like they do. Liars assume others are liars. So it compounds itself in some ways that are very, very difficult. So the whole cheating thing, I don't know that I ever sat down with my children and had a conversation about why they shouldn't cheat. I made all these assumptions about that. And that's not wise.
Has the code of honor that you used to hear about in colleges, has that gone completely out of?
I had somebody that graduated from our place about 10 years ago said they got to Florida State and saw this code, and then they saw what the honor code did to people that cheated and got caught, and decided that was not going to be a good program if she got caught, and said I had to change the whole way I would go about going to school, because we used to do our homework together as teams, and collaboratively, they call it collaborative. Anyway, they would you know, you take these three questions, I'll take these three questions, I'll take these three questions, and we'll get our homework done, and we'll pool our stuff, and you know. So Auburn makes a big deal out of this, the Auburn code, and Auburn graduates here. So So those have some effect on some people whose consciences are already sensitive to doing the right thing. I think they help keep the right, the honest guy honest. I'm not sure they have much to turn on everybody else, but that's a serious. You think about, you know, you're getting ready to go into surgery, and you're going, did this guy cheat his way through school? He's got the YouTube on his iPad over there. Yeah, well.
That's an argument for that artificial intelligence.
Yeah. I told Tom next week, I said, I don't know if you're teaching artificial intelligence, and I'm thinking next week that may be maybe as artificial as it gets. The value of learning, the students to value learning, their response to authority, every instructional situation has an ethic of how do you respond to authority versus how to get around it, how to beat it, how to cheat the system, the stuff that happens all the time in every aspect of life but happens in school just as well. Then there's a whole, the teacher dynamic here. So the teacher ethics, see teaching as a calling and not just as a job. And number two is kind of an intriguing thing to me that's a very, very difficult challenge. Integrity and scholarship and presenting. There's a couple of dimensions here, I think, that call the teacher to ethical conduct. One is the teacher has to be aware of the temptation to oversimplify and to build up a straw man that's easily torn down. And then when they run up against the real deal, it rocks them, okay? So where do Christians tend to build straw men? Probably in the realm of science and evolution, for example, to oversimplify and oversimplify and oversimplify, and then they run up against a polished, Stanford PhD that's an evolutionist and wonder why they can't hold their own, you know. So the respect for complexity, it seems to me like that the people who are the most knowledgeable are the most measured in what they're willing to assert, okay? Now, I know somebody who is a brilliant scientist by all measure, okay? And in talking to him about science and scripture and what science is capable of and what it's not capable of, he's one of the most measured, cautious, careful speakers on that topic. He's not making great sweeping, you know, statements. He's very careful. So the straw man temptation to make it simple so it's easy to be knocked down can leave our students exposed to harder times later. And Robert Tracy McKenzie wrote a remarkable book on First Thanksgiving, Pilgrims, the whole deal. And he talks about history as the biggest thing history can do for us is teach us wisdom. But one of the things he warns about is using history for ammunition, not for illumination. So I'm old enough to remember the Christian history guys. You know, this was a bigger deal maybe 15 or 20 years ago, where they wanted to make every founding father in the country, you know, a Bible-believing Christian, and they wanted to make us God's chosen people, and they wanted to overstate the religiosity of a lot of those people. And it was like, this is what we want to be true. Let me go try to find some writings over here to back that up, and then I can. So it's history for ammunition, not really for illumination. So McKenzie is very measured, but very thorough in his research about, well, what was that first Thanksgiving really like? You know? And wasn't anything like what we think of. And he notes, interestingly, it's a secular holiday, not a religious holiday. But that temptation to go to history to find ammo for our already preconceived position instead of going to find out as much as we can about the past, just as an ex-history teacher. There's the past, that's what really happened. Then there's history, which is what people said happened. And they're not always the same. history, earlier history, was written by people who really were wealthy and didn't have much else to do but write down history. And they had a perspective on that that was different maybe than what the past was really like. So it calls for some careful scholarship before we make sweeping statements. Another thing that's a temptation, I think, sometimes in this piece is you could have somebody who wrote and published and studied over a long period of time. Maybe they were a scholar for 40 years. Okay? And what they said in those first 10 years and what they said in those last 10 years may not be the same positions on something. So to say, just because Elmo Schmuck said this at this time, I'm assuming that Elmo thought that way his whole career and that was his position on everything for all time I'm in. And that may not be true. People change and learn and grow. So you say, well, I read he said this about that and I think that's really bad, so I'm throwing out everything he ever wrote. That makes sense, really? I mean, there's some stuff Luther said that we probably ought to throw something out. So that's a real caution mark to not overstate or to not oversimplify. And there's a tendency to our whole identity politics thing today. So if this person, you know, somebody could be sitting here today and say, oh, he went to the University of Florida. I'm not listening to anything you got to say. You know? And might not be a bad idea. But but the point is, you can guilt by association is a difficult thing. Because somebody works at a certain place or is a part of a certain organization or is a part, you know, then all of a sudden it's just, well, forget it. They don't have anything to teach me. So those things, that the integrity of scholarship and how we present that to the next generation while we're passing on our culture is a very, have to be very intentional and very careful about how we do that. And I mean, you hear David sometimes in the sermon say, well, this here's a comment from this guy. I wouldn't recommend everything he reads, but this is really good. You know, everything he wrote, but this is really good. So it calls for discernment. And there's no shortcuts to that. So, and teachers need to model being lifetime learners and not know it all. And then teachers have a certain amount of authority. So how do you wield authority with grace, humility, and predictability to model, in our case, how do we model the gospel? Every teacher I interview, I ask them that's the same question. I say, tell me about a time you had to apologize to a student or to a class. So if you can't do that, because what I want you to model is I think kids have a hard time admitting to their own sin because they don't see other people do that much. We're all supposed to be good. So if they need somebody to model that I messed up and I hurt your feelings and I'm sorry, would you forgive me? You need to be able to say to a six-year-old, would you forgive me? So how do you model the gospel in that way? If we had 3 or 4 hours, I could tell you some stories about how many times I had to apologize to students. But that's important, that you deal with your authority with grace, humility, and predictability. They need to know, they need to be able to count on what you have to say. So if you say, if you do this, then this happens. Then if they do that, that needs to happen. Otherwise, they can't trust you. They don't know how it all works. So it's the same way with our parenting and all that. You know, we know that. How are we going to build trust? Is trust, when it's present, you're not conscious of it. When it's absent, that's all you can think about. That make sense? When trust is present, you don't think about it. When it's absent, that's all you can think about. I can't trust them. Parent ethics. Parenting is a calling. How diligent are parents about carrying out their role as parents? Now that mine are 37 and 42, it's a lot easier to see what I should have done in a number of places. We're probably all that way. But we need to continue to learn and grow. Integrity with the student and with the school. If you're calling to lie while your school student was absent, please press one. You know, that happens. It's not, you know, that's from a school in Australia, but you know. I missed football practice because I was sick. You were sick because you went to bed at 4 a.m. because you went to the, you know, Monday night football game or something, you know. Anyway, a lot of things happen. So, integrity, values, what a family values in terms of how susceptible are we to materialism and other things about the way we spend our time and our money and the ethical decisions. Leadership. Parents making that choice about where they're going to place their child, knowing their child, knowing the values of their home, knowing what the options are, where's the best place to place my child? And then monitoring their involvement while they're engaged in that particular study. I think one of the things that drives kids to cheat is they're trying to do too many things. They don't have time to study. They got to go here, and then they got to go to this practice, and they got to go to this activity, and they learn their parts for the play, and they got to, I mean, I don't have time to do this. I got, you know, the only place I can be time efficient is help get somebody to help me with my homework, so I don't spend so much time studying, you know? So that's a big ethical challenge there, I think, is to monitor their involvement, teach them to say no to something. Managing technology, how are we going to help our kids with that? How much time are we going to spend helping them? Jeff at school talks about an analogous of how we teach them to drive. How do we teach them to use technology or not use technology? I mean, you know, he sat down with his 5 or 6 year old and said, "So, what would you do if somebody showed you a picture of naked people on the phone?" You know, and this was a little 5 or 6 year old. He goes, "Oh, Daddy, why would I do that?" "Well, never mind, because people are fallen, sinful, and broken, and we can talk about that later. But what would you do?" So he role played that. You know, turn, look away, go take a, sat there in the house and role played that with his 5 or 6 year old. What do you do? Okay, when that happens, you know. And so, given leadership to managing those kind of ethical challenges that face even little kids is important. School leadership has some institutional challenges. Most of you aren't in that world, but just to share a little bit of my world. School culture is shaped by who you hire and who you admit. And you don't always get that right. Okay? Those of you that are in positions where you hire employees, don't you know, how much do you know at the end of an interview? Not much. After you're getting ready to fire that employee and you go back and read the references, you go, I've been doing this one day and I dug it out, I'm reading this. That's what that guy meant by that. So that whole deal is a challenge because, you know, we're hiring a bunch of sinners and they're working with sinners, and what are we all trying to do, get more sinners? When are we going to learn? Anyway, tuition levels and teacher salaries, there's an ethical deal. Gee, I don't want to charge our parents anymore, but I want to be able to have our teachers have a living wage so that we're not, you know, the sacrifices spread, not all lumped on one side of the equation. And then people want more and more programs, so how do you, that takes more people. And, you know, all those ethical stuff has a whole ethical dimension to what. And that's true if you're in a school system. Polk County Schools has the same challenge, I'm sure, you know, just with more zeros on their budget. But it's the same challenges. So what do you value over one? What do you value over other things? Now, number three is a passion of mine. Hours on a transcript versus real learning. So here's the deal. The last 10 years, here's what's changed. The state community college system has opened up all the, you know, Polk Collegiate and opened up the get an AA when you get your high school diploma, get through in a hurry. You know, we used to have a guidance guy that would say, "You know, I can graduate early, then what are you gonna do? I'm gonna go to college, I'm gonna get through early, then what are you gonna do?" He said, "Then I'm gonna go to work." He said, "You're in a hurry to do that?" So, anybody want to hire a 20-year-old college graduate? Me either. So, there's a fast-track mentality. Say, well, if I can get the AA, and then I think all the college tuition money I'm saving. Okay, granted. Let's talk about what they really learn. Now, And we do this, every school's doing it. You can go to our place and take dual enrollment, whatever, and you can take AP this and AP that. Our valedictorian a couple of years ago graduated with 45 hours of college credit. I mean, you can, you know, you don't look like you're going to go to college and start in grad school or something. But you go, do you think that a 10th grade student taking AP World History, getting a 3, 4, or 5 on the AP exam, knows as much as a college sophomore taking Western Civ and having to do all the rigor of that? There ain't no way in the world you can convince me that that 10th grader is going to have the same body of knowledge in his head as the person that took that same course 4 years later with the maturity that they have in the frame of reference and an understanding. Now, you can get the grade on a transcript. That's not a problem. You can fill up transcripts, you know, magna cum, sum, whatever. But what do you really know that you're going to live your life out of, that you're going to actually practice your profession, or you're going to know how to think in deeper ways? There's also a pattern to devalue liberal arts education. So I'm going to get a degree in history. What's the question everybody asks? What are you going to do with that? Okay. Which I'd love to have somebody say, well, I'm going to know how to think and write and compare ideas and analyze and think critically, and that's probably going to help me in life, whether I'm a State Farm agent or I'm a surgeon, you know? So the challenge, part of the challenge of Christian higher education is most of them are built on a liberal arts model, and the culture as a whole is devaluing the value of a liberal arts education. So I work closely with an attorney who says, I don't want the person trying to work in my firm, I don't want the one who all they did was pre-law and this and everything was geared vocationally. I want somebody that can think. Give me a history major, political science major, somebody like that who can write and think. He said, and we're way better off with that person. So that there's an economic driver, which I'm sympathetic to in terms of, look how much tuition I'm saving, but how much they really know and how much have they really been able to mature and develop? And that's a critical decision for parents to make very carefully. That's a pressure point today, ethically, I think, of what institutions are claiming to offer or not offer. Buyer beware.
Part of that is at the other end. I mean, when we closed our plant, I let go a man who was as smart and as good as anybody I know, early 50s. He had no college degree.
Right.
He couldn't get an interview.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Because on the other end of it, there's not looking at who you are, what you know. You can't even get in the door because there wasn't any BA or BS behind us.
Right. Now, I'm not saying don't get the transcript. just saying there's different ways to get it. And some, you know, it's they tell you in grad school, get the PhD now and then change the world later. You know, I mean, do your research project to get the degree and then you can figure out what you really, you know. So there's some, I get that, been there, done that. So I know how that works. Now, ethically too, you know, decisions about resource allocation, those things are all have all ethical tentacles to them that you have to deal with too. And in what you recognize and what you publicly praise, I think there are ethical dimensions to what an institution praises and lifts up as laudable. And one of the difficulties, challenges that you have in the education world is sometimes people figure out what's the easiest thing to measure and declare that to be the most important. You follow that? So,
I'm not sure if this could fall under this number or not, but in the academic world, is it becoming harder or a greater struggle now to justify recognizing kids who excel academically? Hey, let's recognize the honors students and the valedictorians. As opposed to, if we do that, it's at the detriment of the kids who didn't do as well. So let's not uphold those.
We were afraid we're going to hurt their feelings. because they didn't. You have some people that are, and every school's probably got those two or three kids that they could have been valedictorian, but their value system wasn't wired that was the only thing they were going to focus on for 4 years. They were going to have a life. So I think there is some people that in coming out of the back end of the self-esteem movement that would say, well, you shouldn't really honor those kids. It's make the other kids feel bad. You have some of that. One of the things that I've tried, I sometimes have the opportunity to say a word or two before honor roll awards, and my usual mantra is, some of you are in the top 5%. Some of the rest of us make the top 5% possible. We are the foundation of this institution. All right? So knowledge is not accessible on a level playing field. Some people can learn things that you and I will never be able to master, okay? But wisdom is available to all. And that's the deal. There's more students that don't make it in college because they aren't wise than they're not smart, okay? So, because that conditions all your decisions. So I think the emphasis on wisdom is critical, not just on GPA. What do you choose to recognize? What do you publicly praise? What do you praise in your home with the students that live with you? What categories of awards do you give? And what's the basis for those and how much credibility? Again, it's easy to measure GPA. Given the valedictorian award, that's pretty easy. Just crunch the numbers and you got it. So some of the other stuff, you start talking about character, that gets a little bit more challenging. So here's a couple things to think about in the world. You may see some of this in the newspaper. So here's what's coming down the pike in the big picture. Accreditation. Every accreditation body has somewhere they have non-discrimination policy language, okay? So we're accredited by Florida Council of Independent Schools, Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, Association of Christian Schools International, Florida Kindergarten Council. We got all this stuff hanging on the wall, okay? So we got all that stuff. Now, what's coming down the pike is National Association of Independent Schools, California Association of Independent Schools, a lot of independent school associations are now mandating in their non-discrimination statements that not just that you don't discriminate by sex, but you don't discriminate by sexual orientation or, all that whole package of stuff, the whole LGBT agenda, into the non-discrimination clauses of accrediting bodies. So if you can't sign off on that, then they don't accredit you. So think about that, the implications of that for Christian schools, or Christian people trying to do education Christianly. That's going to be a biggie, okay? So that battle is going on right now in our state with the Independent Schools Association, and that's going to be a big deal. Has a lot of potential to it. Now, there's probably 30 agencies in the state of Florida that are that accredit schools. You can find somebody to accredit you. That's not that difficult. But the point is that the higher profile ones that are characterized by more excellence seem to be headed down this slope of requiring that in the non-discrimination clause of their accreditation standards. Something else you may or may not be familiar with is there's a program in Florida called Step Up for Students. The Step Up for Students is basically an opportunity for low-income families to get assistance for tuition to go to private schools, okay? So the way this works is you have corporations who have money that they owe the state tax, okay? So they can take some of that money and they can put it in this bucket in the Step Up for Students program, and that money is distributed to families who meet certain income requirements. Okay? So, they can take some of this money over here. Now, that money from the corporations and goes in the bucket, goes to the families. Okay? So, it's called a corporate scholarship program. A lot of states have them. In Florida, there's several others. There's a Gardner Scholarship or a AAA Scholarship. It's a proliferation of scenarios. Some of them are for special needs students. A McCabe program is for students that need special ed services, and that's state government money, not from corporate scholarship fund. So now what's happening here is what we're starting to see is there's at least one big donor who will go unnamed that has dumped a bunch of money in this bucket, who found out that some of these places these kids are going to school, don't buy into the whole LGBT agenda deal. So they say, well, we're not giving any more of our money. So we're either going to give it to some other charity somewhere, or they're probably not going to pay the tax. They'll figure some way to get out of tax liability. But they say, well, if that money's going to go to those kind of children choosing to go to those kind of schools, we're not going to fund that anymore. Okay? So you may see some of that in the paper. So that the Legal Beagles at the Orlando Sentinel and Jacksonville News Chief and some other places are running around looking at school websites trying to find schools that had a statement like ours that says this is what we think about marriage as a man and a woman, the whole deal, had built all that into our statement of faith. So they're trying to find those schools and trying to leverage the whole shame culture about how could you possibly support such an unloving institution by helping kids go to school there. So what you're going to see in that arena could be in the paper. I got calls from people around the state trying to figure out how we're going to address this when we get called by the press. How are we going to respond to that? And we have prepared statements and all that kind of stuff about how you're going to deal with that challenge. But that's going to be the next major battlefield. The previous thought was the way that you would get at schools like ours or other non-public schools is you would take away their tax-exempt status. Well, that's a threat, but then you're just kind of testing people's level of commitment. But when you start doing this, when you start cutting off the access piece, that can be a significant impact on children, not just on. And it assumes at some level that somebody else is better equipped to decide where your child should go to school than you are. So, because this money comes in a check made out to the school and to the family, and the family has to sign it, we have to sign it before we can cash it. So the assumption, if you have the assumption that somebody else knows better than you about where you should put your child in school, there's some ethical baggage there that's pretty readily evident too. So that's going to be an interesting challenge. So in conclusion, education, the schooling experience is life in microcosm. You see about all the challenges you see in life in microcosm in schooling. Your kids are in school with people that are wealthier than they are, poorer than they are. They're more athletic, less athletic, smarter, not as smart. All the experiences are in there. And that incrementally in this informal curriculum drive and shape what kids are like. Now, just as a humor, this is the history teacher in me, a blast from the past. So, this is a blueback speller. This was a basic book in American public education way, way, way back. This particular edition is 1880. So if you were an 1880 student in our schools in America, you would read things in your spelling lesson such as, God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and all that was made was very good. Or you might read, God governs the world in infinite wisdom. The Bible teaches us that it is our duty to worship him. Or you might read, it is a solemn thing to die and appear before God. Or if you were going to be in the old McGuffey reader, 1881, this is newer, it's a year after this. So the end of lesson 52 in the primer, which is the first one, you're told this. When the stars at set of sun watch you from on high, when the light of morn has come, think the Lord is nigh. All you do and all you say, he can see and hear. When you work and when you play, think the Lord is near. All your joys and griefs he knows, sees each smile and tear. When to him you tell your woes, know the Lord will hear. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your grace, and we thank you for your word that speaks to us across the whole experience of life, including education and all the ethical challenges that face us, that face our children, our grandchildren, our parents, and our colleagues in this effort to try to walk with you in your kingdom. So we pray for your wisdom for each of us in whatever part of the educational arena we function, that you would enable us to think clearly and wisely, to speak clearly and wisely, that we would seek to honor and glorify you and to love you with all our heart, soul, and mind. We ask for your help that we would be able to worship you in spirit and in truth in this next hour. In Jesus' name, amen.